tribute to Murray the K on WNEW-FM.
Tell me, baby. Tell me.
Scott Muni.
I remember when Murray the K and I worked together at ORFM at the very beginning of progressive music and progressive rock. One of the things I remember most about Murray is that he was always late. And I used to have to do the first part of Murray the K show or whatever it was. And sometimes he was late because he was late. Sometimes he was late because he was having a trauma. Murray used to have a lot of traumas, and he had to get himself in a mood to go on the air. And at 6:30 or 6:45, he's supposed to be on the air at 6 o'clock. Murray would be in the boss's office on the sofa getting psychiatric advice from the boss and other people and his music guy, and I'd say, hey, Murray, get off the sofa and get on the air, or else I'm going to... And that was fun. We used to have our thing. And actually, one time, Murray and I lived in the same apartment building here in this massive place called New York City, and the only time I'd ever see Murray, we lived in the same building, and I would see him like 4 o'clock in the morning in a garage. We're both coming in, staggering around, doing whatever we were doing, or I'd see him at some strange hour in the morning. We're both up early, checking the mailboxes out. Hey, Ski is that? How you doing? I say, how you doing, Missouri? And we do all that, and he said, Jackie Decay, and I'm Murray Decay. I say, I know you're Murray Decay, you know. And who am I? He said, I remember you. Yeah, you're Scotso. All right, whatever. And we had a lot of fun. And I'd say, Murray, you know what? If you ever take your hat off and stop dancing with those young girls, the, you know, Murray Decay and his dancing girls and the soiree girls and all that, I said, what are you going to do? He said, I have no idea, but I think I'm going to be in trouble.
Well, what's happening, baby?
Everything's happening, baby.
It's Murray. Murray the K with the swinging soiree.
This is Dave Herman. Before Murray was Murray the K on Wins, he was on the air on WMCA as Murray Kaufman. And he didn't do a rock and roll show. He did kind of an MOR show. We're now talking about the mid-50s, mid to late 50s. And I was a kid at the time and loved this guy's show, 11 to 12, 1 hour a night. And on Saturday nights, he had a two-hour show, and he devoted the extra hour to what he called the record review board. And he would have kids come on the show and review new releases. So I got on the record review board. Me and my friend Barry got on the record review board. We were in high school. And when the whole thing was over, he came over to me and he said, you know, you have a real kind of way on the microphone. You ought to think about maybe going into the business. And I said, I've been wanting to go into the business since I'm about 5 years old. So it was a tremendous thrill. And he then really helped me. He put me in touch with certain people to study with. And I got into broadcasting through Murray the K. It was shortly after that he went over to Wins and became not Murray Kaufman, but Murray the K, and made such an indelible mark and was such a unique disc jockey. And there aren't that many DJs who have a uniqueness like that Murray did. All of us who work here at NEWFM and all of the people who listen to us, I mean, certainly anybody over the age of 23 or 24 who loves rock and roll had to have been influenced by the tremendous hours of fun and craziness and lunacy and submarine watching and all of the great records that Murray played for us all when we were kids. And Murray is gone, but his influence remains, and we got to remember what he was to rock and roll. Now, this interview that I did with Murray that came many, many years later, in fact, this is just a few years ago, had to do with a syndicated special that I was doing on Roger Daltrey and The Who. And Murray, the K, was the very first person to introduce The Who to American audiences way back in the mid-60s. So I went up to Murray's office, and I did a little tape with him. I wanted to find out his first reactions and his memories about the first time he met Roger Daltrey and he met The Who. And that's what this bit of tape is all about.
From meeting with Roger and talking to him, turns out that once again, Murray the K was influential in bringing over people to the United States and getting really involved with them and launching a major rock sensation in the 60s. How did you first find out about them? Because they were totally unknown in the United States.
I was having a conversation with Brian Epstein. I had just
started a station in New York called ORFM, which I guess was the first contemporary progressive FM station. Brian was really fascinated with the idea, and he came over one day and spent 4 hours on the air with me, and then afterwards we were talking. And I had was planning on, you know, my Anista show. I hadn't gotten any ideas of what I wanted to do, but I was sort of leaning away from the Fox show and wanted to do a show that was more commensurate with the new image and the new artist that I was having a lot of fun discovering at that time. A conversation started, and we were talking about some of the acts over in England, and he started to describe a guitar player who would play the guitar with his toenails and with his tongue and everything, and it sounded to me like a guy that I knew in the village by the name of Jimmy James. And it turned out that he was talking about someone by the name of Jimi Hendrix, who had now under the name of Jimi Hendrix and was doing it in England. Well, he gave me a record, a thing called Hey Joe. It knocked me out, not only Jimmy so much, but the bass line in that, you know, just destroyed me because, you know, we were just getting into stereo at that time as far as broadcasting. And I wanted to find out about him, and I was asking about some people who I had played with when I was playing John Mayall, and one of the guitar players was Eric Clapton. And he told me about a new group called The Cream. And he also told me about a group, when we got to talk about Jimi Hendrix, who broke their instruments and destroyed their instruments after each show, and he described The Who to me. I said, well, what's happening? He said, well, we've started an agency, Robert Stigwood and I. What happened was that I got a hold of a record called Happy Jack. And this sort of blew me away because this very mellow, light kind of sound did not connote the kind of excitement which he was telling me about. But then I heard some other things that they had done, and it was going to be an event where I was going to bring all three, and then something happened and Jimmy couldn't make it. So what I did do is I got on the phone with Warner Brothers, who had the rights, and I literally called them five times to force them to put out the Hendrix record. But it took me, when I booked The Who and then booked The Cream on the same show, I went through hell to try to get MCA to release the record. They weren't even going to release the record, Happy Jack. I mean, I literally forced them to release the record, and I brought the fellas over. And I brought over The Cream, and in the same show was The Cream and The Who. This was in 1967. It was the Easter show of 1967, which we held at the Arc Hale 58th Street Theater. I met Roger and Keith and everyone from the group.
Just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Things they do look awful.
Talking about my generation.
I hope I die before I get old.
It was quite an experience having them. First of all, it was an experience for them because they never, I think Hitler was before their time, and they weren't expecting him backstage, you know. And I ran a very tight ship backstage, and especially when I never tolerated stage waits. To me, that was, you know, I never could get into that new form of, well, we're 15 minutes late, we're 15 minutes late. But when you're doing six shows a day and you have people outside, and you know that if you go past 75 minutes in the show, you're paying overtime to your band, that didn't bother me so much, but, you know, the people standing in line did. But here at the RKO 58th Street, on that show, I also had the Blues Project. It was a different concept from the Temptations and the Four Tops and Smokey Robinson, the Miracles and the Supremes. So they had to learn a discipline which they were not used to backstage. And the thing which blew me away is that we averaged four shows a day at the, except when the Rascals, who were very big, I think I ran five shows for the 2 days they were there. But they blew out the entire electrical system of the theater at least once a day.
The Who did.
The Who did, yes. And I'd have long conversations with them, right? And they had this little roadie who would take care of their equipment. And he was sneaking around while the thing was on, and I'm telling people who are my spotters outside, because I always, you know, I'm a stickler for the stage looking right. And he said, we see this guy, it looks like he's ready to bomb the place. He's running back and forth, he's crawling on his hands and knees. And what he was doing was setting these explosive devices, which, you know, when they would do something, it hit a cord or something, and then all this smoke would go up. He almost started three fires and all that, you know. And I had the K girls at that time. And one of the K girls, and Keith, the drummer, were getting it on really good, right? So I decided that I wasn't, you know, I would speak to them, and I'd have, you know, I'd talk about, I'd have these meetings, and there was Eric Clapton and Ginger Baker and Jack Bruce and the entire Roger and everyone. And there I am telling them, you know, that they're not showbiz, which of course they weren't, you know, and that we couldn't do shows like this, you know, because it was, you know, go ahead and do your thing, but do it within, you know, get your act together, you know, don't blow out theaters, you know, these stage waits, it's terrible. And so we'd have these long conversations, and I figured the best way to get through them is use a device. So I used one of the K girls, you know, to try to get the, to explain to them, you know. But it was really a very, it was quite an experience for them.
Roger said it was, of all the things that he's done with The Who and on his own, it was the zaniest and craziest. Was it 2 weeks long? 10 days?
10 days, yeah.
He said the craziest 10 days he's ever had in his life.
Right, yeah. It is. It's an experience. Especially if you, you know, get to a theater at 9:30 in the morning, you don't leave until 1, and then the crowds. And, of course, to see the reaction, you know, it blows away a lot of people who were into progressive radio at that time and now is realize that they were there, and a little bit of history of seeing those two particular groups and The who have gone on to not only stick together but to superstardom and into all of the media. Now, we had incidents. Like, there are certain shows, if you're running five during the days that we run five, you have to throw one show away. You get the two matinees for the teeny boppers, right? And then you want to get two good shows for the evening crowd, so that you have to, in order to keep, because it is a continuous performance. And let's face it, you know, you saw The Who and The Cream and The Blues Project and Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels and Wilson Pickett, and we had a few other, you know, acts there, and the whole...
Even Phil Oakes, I think.
And Phil Oakes was there. Simon and Garfunkel did a night, and so did Judy Collins, which was their way of saying, hey, we like what you're doing radio-wise now. And they were there, and the whole, you know, I never charged more than $2.50. Plus, I went out and I spent $20,000 on screens, so I had a lot of, you know, ways of introducing them via film. So I was very uptight, because this is going to be the first show that I wasn't going to make the kind of money that I was used to making in Fox. It was a very artistic kind of attempt at my, at, you know, of trying to combine the best of rock and the best of a progressive acts. I think that Roger was very intimidated by something that happened. I wanted to tell you about this show, which is around a 5 o'clock show, and the audience at that time, you know, the kids have to get home to go to school, and the big crowd for the evening has not gathered yet, so you do what is called a dinner show. And this is going back to old vaudeville, where you're throwing one away. You know, you have to do one show, which is not the ideal time. They got through during the number, right, after one, and you hear the last thing, and there's like one of those things. And
Citizen
Kane. Right, and one older guy in the audience you could hear say, my God, that's terrible. Like, and I could see, you know, the rest of the band broke up, but I noticed Roger's face when that happened. And I noticed that with the next act, the next time they came out to do their number, or whatever the next show was, he had changed around a lot of the numbers and the approach to the things, and so he was very, very sensitive.
Roger said one night while they were breaking up their equipment, and they actually did have to get all new equipment after each show, and they were doing, as you said, five a day or four a day.
Oh, yeah, but that, see, they never did that before. So what they were doing is they, this little roadie of theirs. I would leave the theater, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'd come back on stage, and there he was with tape and glue, and he was trying to, you know, they just couldn't do it. It would be much too expensive. So what he was doing a lot of pasting up and gluing and things.
And putting the instruments back together again. Roger said he recalled that at one show, while they were destroying everything, they destroyed your personal microphone. Do you remember that?
Yes, they did. They really did. They did. As long as they, you know, at that time, I still had the hat. That was the last show that I ever wore the, you know, the old Murray the K image of the straw hat. And but they took my mic, and, you know, because they would blow out a mic or anything. They were just wild. They were like, you knew, Wilson Pickett said, he said, God damn, man, don't call me down to the stage. Murray, have a heart. Wait till you get those juvenile delinquents off stage, you know, because it would be a mess. And the stage hands, they wouldn't talk to me. I mean, these guys who I knew came over from Fox to do all shows. They said, Murray, have you gone crazy? They're going to ruin you. And believe it or not, they didn't go over that well. They did all of their numbers, everything that we know, you know, for them to do. But it's terrible when you end up throwing, he even threw the drums into the pit, you know. There was utter destruction on stage. It was like the atom bomb hit at every time, you know. And I had to find a way so that whoever followed them, there would be a normal stage rate where we'd close the curtains and have to set the stage up, which, you know, so I had to find a spot for them, because I never would have put them in that spot if they didn't destroy the stage like they did. I would have put them up in a different spot than they were in, because at that time they weren't strong enough to cover, to hold the spot that I gave them. I think that they would get to this great crescendo, this cacophony of sound and the destruction of the instruments and big puffs of smoke and sparks are flying, and you think the world is coming to an end on stage. And they're playing. They weren't kidding. You know, they were giving out. And, you know, there's one thing about them. You know, they weren't throwing any shows, you know. And I felt like going over to him and say, how much would you take to throw the show? But they were really giving it all. And at the end, just to hear a smattering of applause, that's a, you know, that's a bummer. But that's where you learn. You know, you learn that they were used to in England of absolutely destroying the people and having people get as hysterical as they got. But I never tried to hold a performer like The Who, you know. I've never asked them to do another show and say, okay, I brought you over now. Same thing with the Stones. I brought them over as a favor to John Lennon, but I've never, you know, they've never done another show for me, neither has The Who. Roger Daltrey is definitely a superstar who is growing steadily, because he is doing a lot of things and he's building the ladder one step at a time. I started in show business when I was five, and the reason I say this about Roger is he's doing something which Al Jolson, when I was 5 years old, my uncle was a writer, so I did, my first thing was a movie with Eddie Cantor, and my next thing was a Broadway show with Al Jolson, so I really got to start pretty good, you know, with some pretty good company. And I always remember Jolson's philosophy about show business is that if you go up that ladder of success one rung at a time, if you get to the top and you have a bad year or something happens, you only fall one rung of the ladder. But if you go up from the first rung, go all the way to the top, there's nothing there that you have built. You're going to fall right from the top right down to the bottom, and that's happened to a lot of people.
I don't mind the guys dancing with my girl.
Hi, this is Pete Fornital, and I just wanted to add my voice to this tribute to Murray the K because, well, because if you grew up in New York in the 50s and 60s, and if you grew up listening to and loving rock and roll, and if you grew up wanting desperately to play rock and roll records on the radio someday, and then by some unbelievable, incredible chain of events, you actually got to do it, well, then you too would want to say thank you to the handful of people who made it all possible, and Murray the K was one of those people. Thanks, Murray.
Another man with great stature in the rock and roll field is Dick Clark.
Back in the old days when nobody knew what a Beatle was, Murray was astute enough to realize that they had that singularly extraordinary talent, and I guess that's one of the reasons he became the fifth Beatle. He helped spread the gospel. He was an intimate friend of John Lennon's. He made some extraordinary video and audio tapes in his lifetime, but he was the man who helped spread the word.
Once again, Steve Leeds.
Murray was one of the prime innovators of album rock or progressive radio. I mean, you could turn on Murray's show at 6 o'clock every evening, and one time there would be Brian Epstein bringing over a copy of the Magical Mystery Tour or Sgt. Pepper. I mean, the Bee Gees would be on. If you were in town and you were anything, you had to stop by and see Murray the K, because he was the only guy that was playing a lot of records at that point. So his legacy is bringing a lot more music to a lot more people. I would just hope that some people in the industry or outside of the industry would take the time to think about it, and something will happen to Murray the K chemotherapy fund or Murray the K cancer fund, anything that would associate him with helping wipe that out or make the pain easier on others that have to go through similar things, I think would be one of the better tributes to him at this point.
WNEW-FM has given you a special program tonight on someone who is very important, was very important, and will always be remembered as someone, as a great contributor to the fun that is rock music in New York radio, Murray the K. We lost our friend Murray quite recently, and we're proud here at WNEW-FM to have put together a special show tonight for those of you who remember Murray, those of you who never knew him and don't even know the name, so that you know part of rock's history. Our thanks to Earl Bailey, who put all this together tonight, produced our show in memory of Murray the K.
And my thanks to Steve Leeds, whose tapes, records, ideas, knowledge, and emotions makes it possible for DJs such as Murray the K to live on in the memory of his audience.
I quit Wins and decided to get the idea of FM radio and started WORFM. That's my most memorable thing, of starting a whole new concept of radio. That was my biggest thrill, I guess.